Mariella Frostrup will be examining the book choices of The Great and the Good over 70 years of Desert Island Discs with the help from previous castaways Sir Tim Rice and Dame Harriet Walter. That's the prom interval on Monday evening here on Radio 3. Well, a very good afternoon to you. Welcome along to BBC Radio 3 from me, Ian Skelly. I'm here to guide you through our programmes this afternoon, and we're at the proms later. We'll be at the Royal Albert Hall to hear Bach and arrangements of Bach by the organist giving the first of two concerts this weekend, the American organ virtuoso Cameron Carpenter. He'll explore the music of Bach and perform some of his own improvisations. We'll be live at the Royal Albert Hall at 4 this afternoon to hear that, and then again at 7:30 tonight for the first of two special concerts given by the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra and the conductor who's lifted them into the ranks of the best in the world during his tenure, Ricardo Chailly. That's all to come here on BBC Radio 3, which continues with the history of one of Handel's most popular pieces, after a summary of the BBC News this lunchtime read by Lobba Qatari.
An apology by the company which made the anti-morning sickness drug thalidomide has been described as an insult by groups representing victims because it doesn't admit wrongdoing. Thousands of children suffered birth defects such as shortened limbs after their mothers took the drug. The German developer, Grünenthal, has remained silent on the issue for the past 50 years. Paralympics GB have won more gold medals this morning. A short while ago, Natasha Baker won her category in the dressage. On the track, Richard Whitehead won the men's 200 metres for amputees above the knee in a world record time. Britain has also won a third cycling gold with victory for Neil Fashi and his pilot Barney Story in the 1 kilometre time trial for sight-impaired competitors. Teaching unions and some local authorities have been consulting lawyers about the possibility of taking legal action over the grading of this summer's GCSE exams in English. The exams regulator in England, Ofqual, which acknowledged yesterday that grade boundaries had been raised between January and June, said students who'd sat the summer paper had been treated fairly. The Algerian diplomat Lakhdar Brahimi has replaced Kofi Annan as the UN mediator trying to find a peaceful resolution to the conflict in Syria. The Syrian government says its forces have repelled a large-scale attack by rebels on an Air Force college near the city of Aleppo. A man and a woman have been arrested on suspicion of murder following the death of a 3-year-old girl. Lancashire police say paramedics were called to Leah Green's home in Preston on Thursday morning, but she died before arriving at hospital. A man aged 22 and a woman of 20 have been questioned by detectives. People have been returning to their homes in southern Spain to assess the damage caused by wildfires. Thousands of people, including 300 Britons, were forced to flee houses and hotel rooms as the flames reached the outskirts of Marbella yesterday. And the weather, cloud and patchy drizzle in the southeast will be slow to clear, but otherwise much of the southern UK will be fine with some warm sunshine. The far northwest will see strong winds and heavy rain. A band of cloud and rain will sink south later. And that's the latest BBC News and weather. The time is 1:03.
Lobba, thank you very much. The soprano Christine Schaefer and the Nash Ensemble gave the BBC Proms chamber music recital last Monday, live here on Radio 3. And there's a second chance to hear that recital at Cadogan Hall in an hour from now. Music by Debussy and Schoenberg. But first, Lucy Skeeping presents the Early Music Show and a chance to hear a programme looking at Handel's Acis and Galatea.
Thank you. a water nymph, a lovesick shepherd, and a one-eyed monster. Pack your bags, we're off to Arcadia today for one of Handel's most popular excursions into music theatre, Acis and Galatea. Handel wrote it for his patron, the Duke of Chandos. He'd been living in England on and off for a few years now, and he was composer in residence at Cannons, the Duke's handsome new mansion just north of London. Nowadays, the estate is a suburban sprawl of comfy Tudorbethan houses not far from the busy North Circular Road. But in Handel's time, it was a picture-pretty country seat with ornamental gardens and an aviary full of exotic birds. The Duke even maintained a Beverly Hills-style private police force to keep out the riffraff. He also kept a small but well-trained bunch of house musicians who, interestingly, doubled as his domestic staff. And it was they who gave Acis and Galatea its very first performance. Just five singers and a seven-piece band in a semi-staged production. The well-heeled crowd who made up the audience that evening must have felt very privileged to be seeing Handel's brand new work before anyone else. Pastoral subjects were very much in vogue in the early 18th century, and Acis and Galatea, with its Watteau-esque pantomime characters and rich melodies, its touching portrayals of the greatest joy and the deepest suffering, and of course its humorous moments as well, made it an instant hit. In fact, of all Handel's works, Acis and Galatea was the one most often performed during his lifetime. After the overture we've just heard, the stage directions describe the opening scene. A rural prospect diversified with rocks, groves and a river. Could almost be the Duke's back garden. Acis and Galatea to be seated by a fountain, a chorus of nymphs and shepherds distributed about the landscape. Oh, the pleasure of the plains. Not an ode to the expansion of Heathrow Airport, but the cheery chorus of happy swains and swainettas that opens Handel's mini opera Acis and Galatea. And that was St Anthony's Singers with Philharmonia of London in a recording of 1959 with Joan Sutherland and Peter Peers, conducted by Sir Adrian Bolt. And we'll be hearing more of that later. Handel arrived in England right in the middle of a bit of a cultural hoo-ha. Italian opera had well and truly arrived, sweeping just about every bit of English music theatre onto the sidelines. The old native forms like the Restoration Masque or the little musical plays now struggled to put bums on seats, while down the road, the truly fashionable queued for hours to get a glimpse of the temperamental Italian singing stars who seemed to be turning up in London almost by the coachload. There is one God, there is one Farinelli, someone once called out from the stalls as the audience gave yet another standing ovation to this celebrated victim of the surgeon's knife. Mind you, not everyone was quite so pleased. A parcel of Italian eunuchs, one person called them, like so many cats who squall out somewhat you don't understand. This language problem also bothered the poet John Hughes. Nothing is more necessary, he wrote, than that the words should be understood. Otherwise, the point of the vocal music is lost. But the fickle business of show would eventually turn again. Gradually, Londoners began to tire of operas where they couldn't understand a word, and sensing a gap in the market, English composers once again began churning out new works for the stage. In the Italian style, yes, but in the English tongue. Handel undoubtedly would have seen a few of these new pieces, particularly Pepusch's Apollo and Daphne, which was given at Drury Lane just a year before his Acis, and indeed the two works have quite a bit in common. So here we are. Galatea loves Acis and Acis loves Galatea. Well, that's a relief anyway. In fact, he's so loved up that he's neglected his sheep to go and search for her. Suddenly, she's before him and singing one of the opera's prettiest arias, full of sensual, sexy images. She compares herself to a dove, billing, cooing, panting, wooing, and finally, melting in everlasting love. But just as it's all getting a bit steamy, the lovers are joined by the assembled company in a hearty chorus, which Gilbert and Sullivan would be truly proud of. Happy we, what joys I feel, what charms I see.
Thank you.
Norma Burrows as Galatea and Anthony Rolfe Johnson as Acis, duetting happily and blissfully ignorant of the calamity that's about to ensue. Of course, all good stories need a baddie, and here the poet Ovid, who wrote the original tale, has done us proud in the form of Polyphemus, the perfect foil for our two trilling lovers, a one-eyed bogeyman, half man, half mountain, who, as we're going to hear, tells it like it is. "I rage, I melt, I burn," he sings to the hilariously inappropriate accompaniment of the highest, squeakiest whistle, before launching into a clumsy attempt to woo Galatea in his famous song, "O ruddier than the cherry, O nymph more bright than moonshine." Yep, our panto villain is in love. Pathetically, Polyphemus attempts to charm Galatea, but to no avail. He's hardly Brad Pitt, and she's pretty unimpressed by the romantic dinner he promises her as well. Baby's limbs for the first course, with human blood for afters.
Rusty pine, prop of my godlike steps, I lay thee by. Bring me 100 reeds of decent growth to make a pipe for my Thy kidneys blithe and merry, O ruddier than the cherry,
Oh, sweeter than the berry, oh, runnier than the cherry. Oh, sweeter than the berry, oh, runnier than the cherry. Oh, sweeter than the berry, oh, nymph more bright than moonshine night, like Caedmon's blithe. Blithe berry, oh, nymph more bright than moonshine night, like Caedmon's blithe berry. No lily has such luster, yet far to tame as raging flame and fiercer storms and luster. Yet far to tame as raging flame and fiercer storms and luster. Yet far to tame as raging flame and fiercer storms and luster. Ruddier than the cherry, or sweeter than the berry. Oh, ruddier than the cherry, or sweeter than the berry. Oh, gift of light and moonshine night, like kill is blind and merry. Bright than moonshine night, like Kinnelly's blithe and merry, like Kinnelly's blithe and merry, like Kinnelly's blithe and merry. Oh, ruddier than the cherry, oh, sweeter than the berry, oh, ruddier than the cherry, oh, sweeter than the berry, oh, ruddier than the cherry, oh, sweeter than the berry, oh, nymph more bright than moonshine night, like Caedmon's blithe. Blithe berry, oh, nymph more bright than moonshine night, like Caedmon's blithe and merry. Start thou running, still my warm embraces shunning.
The lion calls not to his prey, nor bids the wolf the lambkin stay.
The Polyphemus, great as Jove, calls to empire and to love, to his palace in the rock, to his dairy, to his rock. To the grape of purple hue, to the plum of glossy blue, wildings which expecting stand, proud to be gathered by thy hand.
Of infant limbs to make my food, and swillful draughts of human blood. Go, monster, bid some other guest. I loathe the host, I loathe the feast.
Cease to beauty to be ever whining, love is taking.
the brave their aims pursuing, still be conquering, not complaining, still be conquering, not complaining. Let the brave their aims pursuing, still be conquering, still be conquering, still be conquering, not complaining. Cease to beauty to be sued. Cease to beauty to
David Van Ash as the giant Polyphemus and Kim Apps as Galatea in that recording of the opening of part two of Handel's Aces and Galatea. You're listening to the Early Music Show here on Radio 3 with me, Lucy Skeeping. Well, the graceful Galatea there certainly sounds well worth rescuing from any one-eyed monster. And it's not long before our hero duly intervenes. The climax of the opera comes in the form of a trio, or rather a love duet between Acis and Galatea that gets constantly and rudely interrupted by Polyphemus. It's an amazing moment of dramatic contrast, this. The lovers are spooning away, making their vows to each other, oblivious of the fact that the monstrous volcano man is working himself up into a lava, or maybe I should say lava. Against advice, Acis vows to confront the mighty Polyphemus in a David and Goliath-style rumble in the jungle, but one that's so mismatched that it can only end in tears. Torture, despair, the monster cries, and picking up the nearest large boulder, he hurls it at Acis, killing him stone dead, literally. Here's Les Arts Florissants, directed by William Christie. First Sophie Daneman and Paul Agnew as the lovers pledging their undying devotion before Polyphemus, the bass Alan Ewing, spoils it all by throwing stones. Die, presumptuous Acis, die, he booms as the rock flies through the air and flattens our hero.
mountains, nor moods the turtle dove. The nymphs forsake the fountains, ere I forsake my love.
The flocks shall leave the mountains, nor moods the turtle dove. The nymphs forsake the fountains, ere I forsake my love.
Oh dear, oh dear, the life of gentle Acis is ebbing away, leaving Galatea to mourn him alone. She's soon joined by the chorus of nymphs and shepherds. And by the way, where were all those strapping lads when Acis needed them? And we're now treated to one of the most poignant and beautiful parts of the whole piece as everyone bids an emotional farewell to their dead friend. But before we hear it, I better explain something. I mentioned before that Acis and Galatea was written partly in protest against the tide of Italian opera that was flooding the London stage. Ovid's original story from his Metamorphoses was first translated by Dryden, and then three other poets also seem to have had a hand in Handel's final libretto, John Hughes, Alexander Pope and John Gay of Beggar's Opera fame. So very English it was. However, you'll probably notice that the chorus we're about to hear is actually sung in German. So what's going on? Well, after the first performance, Handel himself rewrote Acis a number of times, making small changes here and there. But its real new lease of life came about 50 years later when Mozart got his hands on it. He'd first heard the piece in the summer of 1764 when he was a little lad of 8 years old. He was doing a concert tour of England with his father, performing his own compositions and sharing the rest of the programme with music by Handel, excerpts from Alexander's Feast, Zadok the Priest and Acis and Galatea. It must have made quite an impression on Mozart, because when about 16 years later a wealthy benefactor, an Austrian baron, commissioned him to make some arrangements of his favourite Handel works, Mozart selected Acis, although, to be honest, in the end, he hardly changed a note Handel had written. He simply rescored it, thickened up the texture by giving the old recorder parts to oboes, flutes and clarinets, and added new parts for bassoons, violas and horns. Have a listen. It does sound amazingly Mozartian like this. In fact, there are moments when you can hear his requiem. Mourn all ye muses, weep all ye swains. Or maybe I should say, trauert all ye musen, wien Schäferfolk.
Thank you.
The nymphs and shepherds mourn the death of Acis in Mozart's German version of Handel's Acis and Galatea, the English concert directed by Trevor Pinnock. Well, seeing a mortal squashed beneath a heavy stone is never a pretty sight, but the sad water nymph Galatea comes up with the perfect eco-solution. She uses her magic powers to transform her deceased lover into a babbling spring. In liquid form, his essence will live on, flowing through the hills and communing forever with nature. And maybe this is the key as to whether Handel actually envisaged that Acis and Galatea should be a fully staged opera or not. Of course, the love scenes, the shepherds and even the monster could certainly all have been acted out with a healthy scenery budget. But when it comes to the touching, passionate end, the transformation of Acis into a mountain stream, well, for the best effect, we must surely allow the genius of Handel's music to take charge. In the end, Acis and Galatea isn't, after all, simply a pantomime of stock characters and clever sets, but a tale of real human grief. So, for the final scene, let's return once more to that historic 1959 recording we heard at the beginning of the programme, conducted by Sir Adrian Bolt, with the wonderful Joan Sutherland as Galatea. OK, perhaps the final chorus, Galatea, dry thy tears, Acis like a god appears. Perhaps that does lapse slightly into doily cart mode. But just before that, Sutherland gives her last aria a really touching simplicity, almost like an old English folk song. It's so pure and understated. Galatea's lost her love, but she's found peace. Heart, the seat of soft delight, be thou now a fountain bright. Purple be no more thy blood, glide thou like a crystal flood. Through the plains he joys to rove, murmuring still his gentle love.
Joan Sutherland with the St. Anthony Singers and Philomusica of London, conducted by Sir Adrian Bolt, with the closing section of Handel's Acis and Galatea. The early music show was presented by Lucy Skeeping and produced by Les Pratt. This is Radio 3, now a second chance to hear last Monday's BBC Proms chamber music concert from Cadogan Hall in London. It was introduced by Clemency Burton Hill.
Welcome to Cadogan Hall for today's Chamber Prom, featuring one of Britain's most celebrated and musically adventurous groups, the Nash Ensemble. They'll be joined by soprano Christine Schaefer to perform Pierrot Lunaire, Arnold Schoenberg's distinctive setting of Albert Giraud's poem cycle that he composed exactly 100 years ago, in which a moon-drunk Pierrot sings of everything from love and religion to violence and blasphemy. Before we get there, though, we've been celebrating the 150th anniversary of Claude Debussy's birth across the proms this year. And previously in this chamber season, we've heard two of his late sonatas that were originally intended as part of a suite of six. Sadly, Debussy only managed to produce three before his death. And this lunchtime, we're going to complete that trilogy with his sonata for flute, viola, and harp. Composed in 1915, when Debussy was battling cancer and was deeply saddened by the events of the First World War that were raging around him, he signed it Claude Debussy, Musicien Français. That year he also wrote, "I want to give proof, however small it may be, that French thought will not be annihilated." Well, if there's intense melancholy in the piece, there's also redemption and light. I was talking to flautist Philippa Davis after the rehearsal today, and she described the work as one of the greats. It's elusive, she says, but it has great exuberance and joie de vivre, and it ends with great ebullience. It's certainly not all misery. Debussy, she pointed out, also sparked a trend for writing for this particular combination of instruments, which she says work incredibly well. The high, sustained sound of the flute, the rhythmic, harmonic sounds of the harp, and that wonderful, sonorous middle register of the viola. So to perform Debussy's sonata for flute, viola, and harp, please welcome to the stage three members of the Nash Ensemble, Philippa Davis on flute, Andrew Vitovich on viola, and Lucy Wakeford on harp.